David here. Hot, you just don't stop it and just get ready to jam. The Disco Daddy Wide World of Hip Hop Radio Show. Every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time. Only on 5Live.com with special guests every week. Don't miss it.
Hello out there, Disco Daddy here. Welcome to another edition of Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. And if you've been following us, and I know you have, you've been really, I'm sure, stuck to the fact that the history of our culture is very expansive. It covers the years from 1970 for first generation up to 1983, which the gentleman, our guest today, is included in the first generation of hip-hop pioneers and legends. And also that there was a history before records were even made. And aside from that, a separate history that was being laid down in film. Okay, this man is unique in the fact that his career began at a moment in time when many of us dream about growing up and getting into films and television. Okay, he jumped right in, or at least it seems that way, and became a star overnight. Okay, he's going to tell us exactly how it happened, the progression of his career, and what it was like, the impact of getting into films when a genre is emerging itself. Hip-hop was still working itself out. There were producers who wanted to jump on films and television and bring this energy to the big screen, and this young man was chosen in an audition. He's going to tell us the process about that. But on looking back, what the impact of that was on his life to achieve something like that at a young age. I'm talking about Mr. Michael Chambers. You know him as Boogaloo Shrimp from the films Breaking 1 and 2 and other work that he has done. But those films, which are cult favorites in hip-hop, actually began his career and gave him a platform for which he's been able to make a living. We're very honored to have him as a guest on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. And Michael, how are you doing?
You know what? I'm doing very, very, very well, and I'm very honored and very, very thankful to be able to be alive and healthy enough, not only to continue to inspire people, but kind of let people know more about who I am behind this image of the guy with the broom, or this whole stigma and this, you know, regarding these hip hop figures who have risen, you know, to worldwide fame, but most people don't really get a chance to know who we are as just human beings, you know, and what we stand for. So I thank you for that platform.
Well, we're going to get into it. We've got a whole hour. You can take a deep breath because Michael can talk, but everything he says is knowledge, so you better pay attention. But we got a full hour of Michael Chambers, Mr. Boogaloo Shrimp. And first of all, like you said, we want to address the fact that many people simply do not know your history. They've seen you in films. They'll say, oh, I know that film comes on. I know that guy. I know who that guy is. But tell us how you began, where you were born at first, before you even get into any of that. And then where you discovered your love of dance.
Yeah, well, my story was really, really interesting. I've always loved that film, The Warriors, because of the fact in the movie, The Warriors, there's this group of guys that were from Coney Island, which is like at the bottom, it's like really by the sea, and they had to make their way to the big city and kind of gain the respect, or you know, demand the respect from these city folks, you know, and then make it back to the island. So with that said, my town was a little town called Wilmington, California, right near the port of Los Angeles, where, you know, corporations have their commodities and their products come from around the world, and these guys would pick them up from the longshoremen would pick them up in diesel trucks and ship them out to other cities. So it was a small seaport community that I was from. But what was interesting, when my dad got out of the Air Force, he deliberately, strategically said to himself and told my mom, I am going to raise our children in a community that had a cultural diversity so that when they get older and in the world, their minds are going to be open enough to be able to blend and adapt with any culture where they're around. So, and then he was like, you know what? You become great. You adapt. And so I didn't understand it until later, but that's what my makeup and that's what my father said, okay, you know what? We know that we're African-American. I was born right in the middle of the L.A. riots. You know, I mean, well, back in the 60s, you know, when they had the Panthers and the whole riot, the movement.
Wow.
My mom said, okay, you know what? And that was happening in L.A., like in other parts. But by that seaport, my mother and father said, okay, we got to make a decision, you know, and what we're going to do is we're going to raise our children to be able to be one with all and earn the respect beyond color. And I didn't connect the dots until I went to my first year of school. And when I finally went to a public school, I realized really quickly that I was closer to Buckwheat and Stymie and the Little Rascals than anything, just because Buckwheat and Stymie, they were very famous, but they were the only bats on the Little Rascals, and everybody else was, you know, was outnumbering them. So that's what I mean. You know, the thing is, when I went to school, like, you could tell who the black people were because I was one of them.
Right.
So the thing is, now, for the duration of the school year, I had to figure out really quickly how am I going to gain the respect of these people and not be like the television show that they're watching after school. You got to remember, now this is getting really serious.
Right.
Back then in the 70s,
right. The
TV series Roots made everybody call black people Kunta Kinte and Toby, you know, Chicken George. And the thing is, it really was a mental mind game to try to get up and go and learn your school knowing that people are going to do pot shots at you. Hey, Toby, hey, Kunta. You know, I mean, that could really mess with anybody. But for a kid, that's kind of like psychological abuse, and you got to really kind of like develop like tough skin, like, you know.
Let me interject this, because that's the first time I've heard that effect from Roots, because I remember when Roots come out and the next day of the streets were clear. And the next day people were talking about the episode. I mean, whites and blacks watched that show. So this is the first time, however, hearing someone who was going to school at that time, and then you going to school the next day. And instead of the positivity that the adults were talking about, having discussions about, you're being called Toby and Kunta. You see what I'm saying?
Oh, man, yeah. You know what?
Wow.
And that was the soft part of the abuse, meaning, you know, the little pot shots. But the other, the darker side, I grew up in a neighborhood where they made sure to let you know, okay, we are the gang here. We are the majority. You guys are just a minority. But it was a very serious Chicano gang there. So the thing is, now the Chicano gang had people that were like, okay, you know what? All right, look. Let me let you know right now. This is our land. This is our neighborhood. And if you're not banging, you will bow down and you will behave and you will do what we have to say, because we'll beat you up or shoot you.
Right.
So the thing is, now there was this submissive thing. Okay, you got the guns and you got the whole army of people. So now I was like, all right, okay, now if I make the wrong mistake, I'm going to be beaten to submission. And I was like, wait a minute. I read somewhere in the Bible that you're not supposed to fear man and you only bow down to God. So I'm like, okay, well, how am I going to do this? So really, I had to really make a very serious decision for my sanity and for my life. And sure enough, when I got to school, my jokes, I mean, I was always a comedian. I was always trying to make light and joke, you know, to just let people know, you don't got to fear me, man. I'm not going to steal your purse. I'm not going to shoot you, man. You know, I could really make you happy if you give me a chance. So I started my own stand-up. You know, I started doing jokes and, you know, just to social interact. Now people are like, man, I love being around this guy, man. He's funny. He always has a upbeat demeanor. So my funniness helped me from getting my butt kicked and actually being accepted by another race. So then what changed my life, like most people in the 70s, Saturday Night Fever. When Saturday Night Fever came out, Lester Wilson, rest in peace, when Lester Wilson taught John Travolta, for the record, how to do the latest dances, because the blacks were dancing and doing the hustle and doing a lot of other stuff, and the Italians and the Spanish were doing disco dancing, and Lester Wilson was a very well-rounded choreographer, when he taught John Travolta the street dance stuff, the freestyle stuff, and taught him what was happening in the clubs, you know, at the Odyssey, Studio 54, Maverick Flat, everything. The thing is, Saturday Night Fever became a hit, and it had the latest, and it had the authentic dances that were in the street cultures from the blacks and the Hispanics. So for me, being in elementary school, when I seen that film, there's an old adage in entertainment. Usually, if there's music, if you're a musician, James Brown said, you got to be on the one. You know, the music will speak to you. Stevie Wonder said, if you're a musician, you will create music in the key of life. The thing is, you draw from life and experiences. You know, you're in your zone. Well, with dance, if you're a dancer, if you see something, it's going to call you. It will evoke that energy for you to just manifest and articulate what that music is making you feel, and people say, wow, he's a great dancer. So for me, when I seen Saturday Night Fever, I was in elementary school. It changed my life because nobody had to teach me. I was watching the film, and then when I would go to people's weddings or like a wedding reception, or, you know, if my mother and father had friends that had parties, and, you know, the 70s music was happening. Everywhere I went back then, everybody played music. That's how we got along as people. You know, we played our 8-tracks. People played your 8-tracks. You know, you had your headphones, the roller skating. You know, you can go to a roller skating ring, and you didn't have to be 21 and over, but they were playing the music at the clubs. So I had a healthy diet of what was happening in the now, right? So when I seen Saturday Night Fever.
So when did you take those first dance steps? When did you look in the mirror? Did you seen Saturday Night Fever? That was the spark for Michael Boogaloo Chambers. But when did you look in the mirror and start realizing, I got some rhythm, I can do the rhythm? What moment did that
happen? Believe it or not, a mirror don't talk back. It's just a mirror. The thing is, I put my skills to the real test. Because a mirror, anybody can practice in the mirror, and that's almost like that's almost like you playing your own ego up, because the mirror is just you believing in you. But if you're really bad, if you're really good at what you do, you put your skills to somebody that doesn't know you, and if you get an audience of one or two people clapping, then you know you got something. So there it goes. Here's the answer. What I did was, once I watched John Travolta, that helped me to kind of get the rhythm of how to move to the disco beat. So the disco beat was kind of through all those hit records. So to be able to dance to that disco beat, you had to kind of like know that rhythm. So that sparked the interest of me being able to move in disco time. But then I started opening my eyes to other things. And so, I mean, I remember Magic Mountain at the time had a disco that was called the Jungle. I think it was the Jungle or whatever. At night, if you took your family to Magic Mountain in the 70s, 78 or 77, about 8 or 7 o'clock at night before the park closed, there was a disco, and they played all the latest music. And I tell you what, that's when I put my skills to the test, because I used to go out on the dance floor. I imitate what I would see and basically just freestyled to whatever the disc jockey was playing. Then I got addicted to going out to the clubs that would allow me, because, of course, I was underage, but amusement park, anybody could be to go to the club. So I would go to Magic Mountain, and then I would watch all the older people and see what they do. So I wouldn't call it like New York used to call, well, if you watch somebody and you took a move, biting. I wouldn't call it biting because, you know what, freestyle dancing is not patented, and it's not even, I mean, it's something that's out there where you just kind of watch a person, and if you get inspired by somebody, you kind of grab their rhythm and do your own version of that step. So
back then,
I just watched any and everybody and how they were grooving to the music, and sure enough, by the time I got to seventh grade from elementary school, Now I'm playing with the big boys because seventh grade was a whole different group of people. A lot of people were bussed in from San Francisco. The Samoans, right. The Polynesian bomb came to the South Bay. Samoans and Filipinos and Koreans. A lot of people came from up north and that were bussed into my school. So they had that up north influence. So some of the guys that were at my junior high school, they were already influenced by dancers from Pier 39, Granny and the Robotrons, a lot of those people from Frisco, San Francisco, and Fillmore, all Berkeley, all that. A lot of children of the funk children, the Sly Family Stone, hippie kids, beatniks. I was kind of in a very, very well diverse junior high school. So this is when I really was sowing my artistic oats, because now I was this little guy who had already been into dance in elementary school, but when I got to junior high, these other cats had that really big LA and Frisco kind of thing going on. So now I put my skills up against that, and that's when I stood out. And you gotta remember, when I went to my junior high school, the surrounding cities were Carson, California, Compton, Hawthorne, Inglewood. A lot of the bigger city in LA, some of the people that moved to our area to get good jobs were forced to bring their kids down there. So those kids brought a lot of their influence to my school. So the thing is, now I was able to master my style of dance because I say 1978, 79, when you got Uncle Jam's Army and Uncle Jam wants you to funk with him, you know, and all that really great funk music, Confunction and Barcades, you know. I mean, all that real big stuff. The thing is, you know, and then that cosmic kind of thing that George Clinton was doing. And George Clinton, when Parliament came out and they were coming out on stage in spaceships and spacesuits, that science fiction thing correlated with me because I understood it. Not only was George Clinton in Parliament doing science fiction, but now, look at the angles where I was drawing from. The music was scientific. Parliament had the spaceship and the mothership, you know. So no, it was devoid of funk, right? So I had that in my ear. But then when I watched television, you had Jamie Summers, the Bionic Woman, Steve Austin, now Bionic Man, you know, or Clash of the Titans, you know, Jason and the Argonauts, all this really cool stuff. So the thing is, whatever steps that I was doing went 0 to 60 because instead of hanging out at the clubs or whatever, which remember I was underage, my little laboratory to practice was my room because I was the baby. I was the youngest of my family, so I had to stay in my room with my mom, you know, do my homework, right? It got boring. So it was just basically, I would go from my music, I would go for my music. You know, remember 1580 Katie had all the jams, right? So I would go for I would listen to Katie and put my music on and then practice my stuff, and then I would watch TV. And I tell you what, one day at school they had a Sadie Hawkins dance, and that was, I mean, in my school still has the yearbook log. I have the picture. And I had been watching everything that I could, even the Gong Show when they had Chuck Barris and some of the dancers from San Francisco, Grammy and Robotron, dance on there. I was picking up the idea, if you were a pauper or a robot or a mime, you know, you had a king like a pimp, you know, and you had either a derby or a tuxedo hat, and then you had white gloves, and you had your coca sacks and your khakis. So the thing is, so I was G'd up back then in poppy gear. I mean, I had my white gloves on, and you couldn't tell me anything. And then I had the right attitude. So when I got to Sadie Hawkins, I had an afro wearing surfer puka shells because I was hanging out with, like, surfer dudes. And the thing is, when I stepped on the dance floor and I heard my favorite song, that's when I knew I had something, because everybody that had known me as the class clown started looking at me like, uh-oh, wait a minute. Michael's really popular, because did you see the way he was driving? Did you see the way he was moving? Did you see how animated he looked? He looked like a toy. Pretty soon, the teachers that used to put me in detention for running my mouth, because I was like Chris Rock's illegitimate brother. I want to win. No, not a whole snap, just one. No. The thing is, that'll put you in detention real quick, right? So the thing is, the teachers knew my name as the class clown, but pretty soon I realized, wait a minute, now the teachers are respecting me because I was the guy, Michael McGlider, you know, it's like they would just see me glide by, you know, like, hey, Mike McGlider, you know, the Boogaloo guy. The thing is, people just started labeling me, and they would tell me, you know, when they would see a crowd dance, they would, you know, people would be doing the robot and pop locking, whatever, but people forget the terminology back then. If you were a pop locker, you wore white gloves or whatever and suspenders, and people would say, man, he pop locks. Or if you Boogalooed, James Brown, they even had songs. Boogaloo, I'm Broadway. Boogaloo was a terminology, and it was always attached either with radical occasion. You know, the boogaloo was kind of like a occasion thing. In Cuban and Latin rhythms, they had boogaloo. Celia Cruz has a song called Boogaloo. You know, George Ringo Starr of the Beatles had, you know, in Latin, he said, back off boogaloo. So boogaloo was a universal title. So eventually, people kept telling me, I mean, kept yelling it out. When everybody was dancing, they'd be like, wait a minute, you ain't seen this guy. They'd be like, come on, boogaloo shrimp, just boogaloo on him. So the thing is, that's where I got my name. I was a guy, because I was a shorty, I was a little boogaloo, a little shorty coming up, right? People be like, nah, you ain't seen nothing until you see him boogaloo on him, shrimp. Wow. So they would actually call me out to do my boogaloo, and now everybody was like, see, that's how you do it. This is how you do it.
Let me ask you, Mike, you got that, you started using that name in high school.
No, I got boogaloo shrimp in junior high school.
Junior high school, okay. I just wanted to get it clear. So that's how long.
Yeah, the person that actually gave me my first jacket, which back then, just like any crew or any car club or whatever, if you had a name, advertisement was everything, right? So people would go to the freeway surplus and get the old English letters and advertise your name, right? So the thing is, I would see all the groups, you know, have their names, whether it was whoever it was, electronic puppets or whatever, they would have their names, you know, on their jacket, so you know who you were dealing with. So one day my sister kept hearing everybody talk about me, even in her school, and she was like, wait a minute, my brother is so popular, I'm going to get him his jacket. And she surprised me one day with my first jacket that said Boogaloo Shrimp. And everywhere, because it was sentimental, because it was a gift from my sister, I wore that jacket until I didn't fit it anymore because I grew up. So I ended up having to rip the I ended up having to rip the sleeves off, so at least I still had my jacket from my sister. But I had no idea. Every house party and every battle and everywhere I went with my jacket, it was like, who was that masked man? His name was Boogaloo Shrimp. I didn't even have a girlfriend, but at the end of the day, when they said, you know what, so how did it go? I was like, you know what, I made them say my name. I was like, I made them say my name, mama, they said my name.
Michael Boogaloo Shrimp on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. He's telling us about his early beginnings, and it's a fascinating story.
And I made them say my name.
So now you're in junior high school. The word is getting around about this young man, this fantastic dancer. Let me just ask you one thing that was going on that you didn't leave out, but I know you didn't leave out intentionally. What affected the show, watching every Saturday morning with the rest of America, did the show Soul Train have on?
Well, Soul Train for me, it wasn't so much the dancing because, I mean, my people dance. So it was like I was like looking at the life we were living. But the fashion and the fact that being black was not something looked at, it was beautiful. I mean, everybody used to say, you know, wow, you know, he's so dark, you know, how can you mix? How can you mulatto? You know, he one of them darky, you know. And, it, you know, job not be here, it wasn't cool. So we were like, damn, so, you know, I wasn't born looking like Ken and Barbie. I was born with this hair, you know, so, and my skin is not going to get any lighter. You know, I'm mocha chocolate, so what you want to do? So the thing is, people always talk about why black people have attitudes. You'd have an attitude, too, if you were picked on every day because you were black. So you get tough skin and you knock somebody out. Like, what you want to do? You don't like me? What's that? So the thing is, you know, we were always trying to defend our humanity because this is what we were as a people, dark, right? So for me, to see Soul Train and to see afros and nappy hair and doo-doo braids and people smiling and shining, I was like, wait a minute, this is really a breather from the stuff that I'm enduring because these people are on TV and happy and dancing how they want. And I was like, okay, well, you know what? And it is very true. That Soul Train gave a different image to what we thought black was. And I got a chance to see the different shades of black. We come in all shades of colors, high yellowish, light, big, extra chocolate, purple, but we're people. Yeah. You know, so I was like, you know what? You could say whatever, but I'm going to do what this group of people are doing and try to be as happy as I am, and I'm going to stay black.
Hey, there you go. There you go. Now, Michael, you got to a point, obviously, where you found you had this talent and it was getting you recognition. So take us up to the point where you start thinking about doing this as a professional, career. And then the audition, which I assume you had to audition for the film. Take us into that progression. You got either heard about the film or you heard about an audition. How did all of that come about?
Well,
were you still in school at the time?
Yes. Well, as I started getting really, really good, I mean, by showing off, I was literally exercising my chops. And, you know, if you look at semesters, you know, a school semester is a long time to be doing the same movement. So to stay entertaining and to stay popular, I had to kind of improvise and come up with new stuff. So I was like, what else do you got? Instead of doing the same moves. So I was always I was still on a journey with my craft, trying to learn more about my dance and to try to just be better, you know, and find another group of people who did what I did. And so, you know, through seventh and eighth grade, that's all I did was practice dance and associated with dancers. So eventually, by ninth grade, I was asked by the high school drill team people if I could be the school's mascot because they heard about me. So the thing is, I was like, wow, now the high school that I'm getting ready to go into, they're already saying, no, they already know my reputation as being a bad dancer. They wanted me on that school field to help promote the band, right? So I was like, wow, this is really cool. And then once I did my first high school game, somebody said, hey, you know what? They told my brother, there's some people, you know, who play guitar and sometimes they play a saxophone and they do little tricks to get some money. See if your brother can make some money by the pier. And so the beach pier where I live was Redondo Beach Pier, Redondo Beach, California. They had a pier. And so my brother and his friend took me down there with a boombox and with lyrics of my favorite song. And they just said, you know what, just go over there on a Friday when everybody's off work and do your best routine and see if they'll pay you. And sure enough, I got addicted to that because I'm telling you what, to be black in the neighborhood and make honest money, you couldn't tell me anything. And the thing, I had an afro. You know what, I was black and seely, but so what? The thing is, I was free. So the thing is, when I put my music on, I started dancing, the rich people, we had Palos Verdes, which is a very well suburb of South Bay. Palos Verdes, Rolling Hills, all those people, you know, they pretty much, they know quality, they know people struggling. So the thing is, after I did my shtick, I would get like $5, $10, sometimes 20, or sometimes a whole bunch of ones or chains. But to be like 11 years old making that kind of money, I was like, wow, I got addicted to it. And I knew right then and there that this was a business. I mean, if I dance, I get paid. So it was a no-brainer. It was a lot better than a paper route. So Now I took, not that people were out for bad, but I'm just saying the money, the denomination, the performance money was a lot bigger and quicker. So then an hourly rate, I just got the full Monty, right? So here's the deal. So now I was looking for any other avenue to dance and get paid for. So I met some friends who were living in East L.A. My aunt was from Boyle Heights, and my dad used to be in a car club. So the thing is, there was other cities in East L.A. that didn't have the black problem. You know, it was like, okay, you know, this guy's cool. You know, we're not tripping our race. Just be you and have respect, and it's all good. So it was no game or anything. So I was able, from my mom and dad's permission, to spend some of my summers with a Mexican family that were into disco and into like the house parties. And so I was really kind of like a rare item for the city of East L.A. because there weren't that many blacks over there, like in Whittier and Pico Rivera and Montebello. There weren't really a lot of blacks, so I really stood out. But you know what? Because I came with the right attitude and because I danced, I was able to grow as an artist and as a specialty, exercise my chops, but yet make a living at the house parties. So every party, I was like killing it, you know, and making, you know, a couple $100, if not, you know, I mean, it was all this money. Pretty soon, somebody told me, hey, man, you know what? If you could just find a way to get on the other side of town, this is East L.A., bro, but if you could kind of like get up there where L.A. and Hollywood is, maybe you'll be able to get discovered. I'm like, yeah, right, me, get discovered. Yeah, right. And sure enough, one day me and my friend were watching television, and I think the music videos were now I think it's like 1980, 81, 82, and music videos were coming on regular television. You know, people were you know, you had MTV, but sometimes the regular channels would do videos. And I will never forget, the video that changed my life was Rod Stewart had a video called Young Turks. Young hearts be free tonight. That song was a hit for Rod Stewart, and in the video was the first popper that I had seen in a music video. There's a guy in the video dancing like by the railroad tracks or on top of a building, and the thing is, I was like, oh wow, and he was popping. I think he was from that group Chain Reaction, Tom Guzman Sanchez, Paul Sanchez. He was dancing in there, And then I found out later those guys were in the movie Xanadu. And so now you couldn't tell me anything because I had my heart set on being television because I said, okay, now these are people like me, and they showed that they had a job. So now I was like, okay, I got to do something. So eventually I went to Uncle Jam's Army's dance, and they had at the Long Beach Convention Center, Uncle Jam's Army Convention, and the Electric Boogaloo showed up there. Everybody that was there. I mean, Egyptian Lover was there. I mean, and this guy that I had really heard about for the longest time, Poppin' Taco. Now, this was not a racial thing. His name is Bruno Falcon, but back then they had a franchise, a restaurant franchise called Poppin' Taco. So people called him Poppin' Taco based on the restaurant, which was called Poppin' Taco. So I kept hearing about a Mexican guy that could dance better than black guys. And that, for me, at that young age, I was like, no, wait a minute. People from my DNA was just born with it. It's a gift. And so I was like, nah, I need to see this. I have to see this guy that people said dance better than black people. Man, yeah. I went to Uncle Jam's Army and I saw this guy, and he was from Texas. I'm telling you what, this guy changed the game of freestyle popping. I mean, and he became one of Michael Jackson's consultants with, you know, Michael's stage show and with Michael Jackson's routines in some of his music videos, Captidio and Smooth Criminal. When it came to popping, Poppin' Taco was the consultant for those numbers. But yeah, Poppin' Taco, he actually played electro rock in the movie Breaking, the guy that was our rival. So him and I knew each other before the film on the street level. And we used to practice. He was from Long Beach, I was from Long Beach. We used to practice, because I couldn't get enough. Can't get enough of that funky stuff. So we was just practicing, and sure enough, it was ground zero, those sessions in Long Beach, when phone calls were coming through his house. People were calling him saying, hey, Bruno, they're doing this music video, they're doing this. Do you want to come? And I happened to be there at the house, and he's like, hey, Shrimp, do you want to go for this commercial or for an audition? I'm like, sure. So through word of mouth, we started auditioning. So I got my first television commercial. It's for CBS, the CBS. It was like a promo for the channel CBS called We've Got the Touch. Him and I and the group Chain Reaction, which I referred to in the Rod Stewart video, we all danced on the CBS commercial, and I got my first check, and that just took me 0 to 60, because now I was in the loop, the Hollywood loop, looking for auditions, you know, doing stuff part-time.
That is fantastic.
And my name got known very quickly because my skill was up to par to be able to be recognized with people that were already older than me. So by dancing with Bruno, I got the attention of Adolfo Quiñones. Shabadoo, for the record, was not the best locker. Adolfo Quiñones was not the best locker of the group, the Lockers, period. It is very true. Don Campbell, Fluky Luke, Fred Rerunberry, Tony Basil, you know, and Tony Gogo, all these great guys were in the group before Shabadoo. But one thing that I will give credit to Shabadoo about, Shabadoo and Tony Basil, they were the business people. Meaning, they weren't trying to do, they were not trying to dance for bragging rights in the clubs. They were trying to make some money and get known and turn it into a career. And they were the ones that were always leading the people in the business to groom themselves and make themselves presentable so that they could be, you know, actually stars. So they had already, you know, been traveling with the group, the Lockers, and doing Saturday Night Live and Soul Train, all these TV shows. So when Shabadoo heard about me from Poppin' Taco, Poppin' Taco said, you got to see this little guy, Bruno the Shrimp. I had no idea Shabadoo was looking for a new group. The thing is, the Lockers were already 70s and outdated. So, and as a matter of fact, he had branched off to to do his own Latino thing. You know, he was kind of like on this Cab Calloway, Bob Fosse thing. So Tony Basil was embarking on choreography, and then she came out with that hit single, Oh Mickey. So they both went on the bigger thing. So by the time Shabadoo heard about me, the reason why I was appealing to him and Popping Taco, we were the new Jacks on the block, and we were moldable because we were young enough and impressionable enough to follow his direction as far as if he got a production and if he wanted to control the team, we were kind of like under his wing. So the thing is,
he was like, he was
as far
like
as a mentor,
he's like 10 years older than you guys, right?
Probably more, but he it's okay. Yeah, he was probably more than that. But the thing is, for me, that took me more 0 to 60 to start understanding, okay, there's a difference between battling on the streets for bragging rights, and then there is a way to carry yourself to make yourself presentable to be employed and to stay employed instead of giving yourself away for free. So Shabba used to say, you know what, if you give it to him for free, what makes somebody else want to pay for it? He said, keep yourself dignified and treat yourself with respect, and they will pay you. And sure enough, you know, we started understanding our worth by the fact that there were really not a lot of people that were like us, who could show up on time, who could be professional. Anybody that's been in the business, you know for a fact, it's not just talent. It's your work ethic and how you carry yourself that keeps you in the business. So the thing is, we were being groomed to be professional dancers, not just for bragging rights. And so that's one thing that I will always give credit to Shabadoo and Tony Basil for, because there were a lot of people that just stayed in the neighborhood for bragging rights and never went anywhere with their career because they did not know how to navigate it.
Wow.
So once I was under their wing, what was that?
I said, this is fascinating. I just want to do a break here. This is Michael Boogaloo Chambers on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop, dropping bombs. Continue, my brother.
Yeah. So the thing is, you know, all respect and credit due. You know, Tony Basil, you see what she did going from being just a locker to being an icon associated with the 80s and a very prominent choreographer for street dance. So the thing is, and Shabadoo's name is there because what they did, they rose above just the cattle call of dancers, and they groomed themselves, and they had a certain dignity to their art form, which helped pave the way for people to go, okay, you know what? Street dancers can either dance on cardboard or dance, you know, in clubs and get the clubs rich, or you can open up your dance school or go and teach your style and have it for generations to come. So I was under that kind of grooming. And the thing is,
now did you join his group?
I don't want anything this deep misinterpreted, you know, because when you say you join something, then that means that you've got to, like, when it comes to a professional career, when you join something, even if you join a music group, you're assigned to a record company and you are labeled as one of the members of that group in a contract. So you got to remember something. Let's go back. We were friends. We made friends on the street level, and we all had our positions. I was a popper and a master of what I did. Bruno was a master of what he did, and Shabby was a mastermind at what he knew business for. So the thing is,
you co-founded this thing, man. It was like you
co-founded. So you know what? I mean, I think it was more of a partnership. Like we're friends. Okay. Let's cooperate with each other. We'll do the labor. You do the talking. You know, and let's get in there and get some money. So it was one of those things. We would walk in and auditions, and we would kill it because he knew how to talk and hustle, and we knew how to do the muscle. So the thing is, if you really look at some of the productions,
what was the name of the group?
Well, you know what? For the breaking and entering documentary, which was directed and produced by Topper Carew and Rainbow Television, back then, once we started. you know, doing music videos or whatnot. Somehow or another, Topper Carew, he wanted to do a whole documentary, you know, but from the West Coast perspective. Back then, you know, back then the East Coast had Wild Style and a documentary of hip hop, you know, all these underground stuff, but that was New York. So Topper Carew said, wait a minute, there's something happening in L.A., and we need to go and interview all the top people. So the thing is, because I was a soloist from a really small town, but I had been running in the right circles with students of the Electric Boogaloos, with some of these top players, Shabadoo and Topper Carew said, okay, you know what, instead of, you know, Bruno and Shrimp just kind of as being individuals, let's just label it just for good, you know, just to make the continuity with the film go. We'll call them the Shabadoo crew. There was no official Shabadoo crew, but Shabadoo's crew was basically just us, all of us as friends, who basically it played good for the camera, because to have it labeled as a Shabadoo crew, the thing is, it made sense why we would be in Radiotron and why he would be an announcer in that documentary. So the thing is, you know, it was just basically for the documentary, but years later, we didn't, even in the movie Breaking, if we were really the Shabadoo crew, it would have said in the credits, Boogaloo Shrimp Electro Rock was played by the Shabadoo crew, but it never was, right, because that was never an official crew. It was just for that documentary. So here's the deal. So once we started getting momentum, and getting people started noticing, okay, these guys, they roll together. If you call Shabadoo, he's got Shrimp, he's got Bruno, he's got Anna, he's got Little Coco, and there they are. Sure enough, that's when the word started getting out that, you know, we could get some very professional dancers who show up on time, get the job done, you know, and still be better than some of the people, you know, who are not out there. And sure enough, our first job as a unit was the Lionel Richie tour. Lionel Richie had the song All Night Long. And the thing is, Jim Craighead, his manager, told him, Lionel, because Lionel doesn't dance. Lionel's a songwriter, but Ken Craighead and his people told him, look, to really push this song, he said, you need to kind of like get a music video with what's happening with, and kids are dancing on the streets and da, da, da. So what they did was, if you look at All Night Long, they made a makeshift street, and Lionel Richie's walking down the street, and there's kids dancing on the left and on the right, just people dancing. So they were kind of imitating their version of what was going on in the world, and that's what made it work. So if you look at All Night Long, there goes the roadmap to all of our careers. Shabadoo's featured as the dancing chauffeur. Me and Pop and Taco are dancing side by side doing our what we do. And once that video hit and Lionel Richie actually won a Grammy and many awards for that, we did the American Music Awards dancing on stage for All Night Long with Michael Jackson in the audience. Okay, now check this out. This is very, very sensitive and very important. When we did Lionel Richie's All Night Long tour, we joined the tour in 1983. It was 1980. The tour jacket said the tour went from 1983 to 1984. So we were on the road for like 9 months, okay? So a lot was going on, and a lot of trend setting in the world was going on. Right. Not only were we the latest thing, but we were the showcase thing, because we were right with Lionel Richie, who was like the hottest thing on the planet. So here's the deal. Right around that time, I had met Michael Jackson. Me and Pop and Taco met Michael Jackson a few years before we joined that tour. What happened was, I in L.A., Paul Moyer, did a segment on street dance, you know, for one of their segments. And we were dancing on Hollywood Boulevard, and all the dancers on this segment came to Hollywood Boulevard, and Paul Moyer did this segment for INLA Channel 7 about the culture that was happening on the streets of Hollywood. So in that segment, I had a feature of my moonwalk gliding combination. And the thing is, just before I kind of got any camera time, I was just dancing as like this new Jack coming up, you know, underground. But the person that was kind of like really, really famous was Jeffrey Daniels. Jeffrey Daniels from Shalimar, I mean, he wasn't the greatest, he wasn't the best singer of the group, Howard Hewitt was, and Jody Watley, but when he came to dancing, Jeffrey would come out and do his, you know, he would do his pop lock and that, and he did his backslide. So the thing is, Jeffrey got so much camera time, and he kind of had the size and the stature of what one of the Jacksons would look like. The Jackson family, all the brothers were tall and had the big afros, right? So if you look at Jeffrey Daniels, for me, all those stories that Jeffrey Daniels taught Michael Jackson, okay, I was like, if people could put two and two together, if somebody taught Bruce Lee, I want to see some of that stuff Bruce Lee does. You know, I don't, you know, you could say whatever, but if you say you taught Bruce Lee, I want to see what Bruce Lee used to do. So for years, I used to just kind of just bite my lip because I was like, wait a minute. Everybody kept giving all this credit for Michael Jackson's freestyle to Jeffrey Daniels. And I'm like, wait a minute, there's footage of him dancing, but not the way that he danced after me and Pop and Taco danced with him. So my point is this. Before I came on the scene, Jeffrey Daniels he was showcased because Shalimar was a really hot group. And matter of fact, right. Don Cornelius made it a point to push Shalimar because they were former Soul Train dancers. Shalimar had a very good kind of advertisement muscle with Solar Records and the whole Soul Train thing just because they were part of Don Cornelius' crew. So everything in the media and all the camera time was Jeffrey and them. Well, check this out. So everybody in the business was looking at that group, and sure enough, Michael Jackson was not. He wasn't foolish. He was a genius. He looked at Jeffrey Daniels doing his solo so much that he was able to do that step, which was popular, because for a black man being that height, he was kind of like the same height as Michael, had the same kind of build. Michael was able to grab that step just before he did Motown 25, and he pulled it off. He pulled it off even after Motown 25. When Motown 25 came out and Michael Jackson, the whole world said, man, Michael Jackson moonwalk, nowhere in the press at that time did they say, Michael said, I owe this to Jeffrey Daniels. He never said that. He never said that Jeffrey Daniels was the one that taught me that before I went on the show. Years later, when Michael Jackson was known as the dancer that he was, he didn't have to give credit to anybody. Because he was like the guy that was a genius. So when the credit of who taught Michael was up for grabs, just like a domain name. The thing is, I had already did the movie Breaking. I had already worked with Michael Jackson on the Victory Tour and in private sessions. So the thing is, I know for myself, I wasn't really pushing the issue to get a lawyer or somebody to take credit for what I did with Michael. It was just something that I did, but I didn't really, like, try to use that as my moniker every job, right?
This is for history. Michael, from your association of working with him, saw the moonwalk, which we've named it actually, but you didn't call it the moonwalk, but he saw that step way before he met Jeffrey Daniels.
Oh yeah, most definitely. Matter of fact, you could go on YouTube and look, that step has been around since Cab Calloway, even Charlie Chaplin has done it.
Yeah.
But check this out, Michael Jackson wasn't alive when those people were there. But here's the deal. Everything always has a new you just kinda like a new life. So the thing is, in the 80s when people were breakdancing and pop locking and all this, those steps kinda got a new life. And moonwalking was kind of like a simulation of gliding and kind of like a floating sensation. But before that, there was the backslide where people were like, okay, you know, I'm a backslide. And, you know, look at the word backslide with your back and you slide
backwards.
Right.
I remember that.
So what Michael Jackson did on Motown was the backslide, and that went over so well that when he got with me, he was able to add to what he had already. If anybody knows anything about Michael Jackson, he always tried to do better and top himself. So the thing is, the whole world was like, oh, wow, man, look at that, man. Did you see Billie Jean? That step. Well, Michael Jackson didn't stop there. Right. He was like, you know what? The thing is, when him and I got together, just before the victory tour, him and I got together, and Michael was like, wow, you know, just do what you do. And he was like, wow, this is interesting. And he was like, do it again. And I was like, okay, but he's like, excuse me, do it again, okay? I was like, all right. So I just kept showing him.
I just got a kick out of it
because here I am, this guy from the neighborhood, and he's a millionaire, a very popular guy. He's looking at my feet, and he's the one everybody's talking about. So I thought, I'm like, shh, you couldn't tell me anything, because I felt, you know what, I felt like, wow, you know what, no matter what, even though people put me down, whatever, I got somebody that's got more money than you, that's more famous than you, and he likes the way I dance. So I said, I was good for that. You know, I was so naive and so humble that, you know what, all I cared about was just being able to be acknowledged and be a friend to him. I didn't come at him with some lawyer and a whole bunch of people hollering, all the Jacksons over here smelling money, you know, the gold diggers, you know. I was like, you know what, I know this guy's rich, but that's what he earned because that's what he does. But I go, if he's just going to spend time with me, then I feel honored and I'm going to work with him. And so I think Michael saw the nobility in how I didn't try to, like, get stuff from him, but we were willing to just kind of work together. So the thing
But I want to ask you just your personal opinion of what type of person Michael, you're the first person I actually talked to, like an intimate working relationship with him, and just what type of person was Michael Jackson? Because he's
when I met him and we worked together. Mm-hmm. He was like a grown man. He was like a child in a grown man's body. He was like really like fascinated. Like, wow, look at this. And he just had the excitement of a kid, but yet he was a grown man. And the thing is, I guess that's why I felt like we were kind of like, I mean, I felt like I belonged there because he was like my buddy. Like, hey, we're cool, dude. I kind of felt like, if you ever seen the movie Big with Tom Hanks, when he became a child, he was a child in a grown man's body, but he still had a best friend who was a kid. But they were like, cool, and he seemed beyond the grown manness. That's how I felt with Michael. It's like, he's a grown guy, but he's a kid in a bigger body. So it's like, we're cool. Just chill, man. It's all good. So we had this relationship, a working relationship. I'm going to clear that.
Right.
We had a working relationship, but it was more like we were on the same level mentally. Because all we did was just shut up and dance, put the dance shoes on, man. He asked me what he wanted to learn, and I would do it, and we would have our jam sessions. And the thing is, he learned more from me in such a short amount of time with all the choreography and political rhetoric, just straight up dance, shut up and put the music on. That's why when I look back at the few sessions that we had over a few years when his schedule permitted it, I really was proud to see how much that he got from me because, I mean, we just kind of like, it was just like a serious dance sparring session, meaning no phones, no interruption, just put the music on and hit it. And the thing is, Michael was able to learn how to freestyle solo. If I was to take one credit that I could say for the rest of my life, what I contributed to that man, it would be I allowed him to learn how to explore his freestyle. Because to be able to be a popper, you got to improv. You got to know what to do, and you got to come up with your own flavor. You know, while everybody's doing the same move, you got to have your own signature way of doing it. So the thing is, I accomplished that.
What was really sneaky
and genius about that man is we practiced, and he would just be doing a lot of looking, and he videotaped. But he didn't really show me what he did until he perfected it. So he'd be like, our session was like that video jam with him and Michael Jordan. If you look at when he was teaching Michael Jordan, he's like doing his feet, but I mean, that was a little bit over the top, but he's like going in all different angles to perfect the thing. That's how Michael would want somebody to do something. He would look at a dancer trying to teach him something like a camera angle. If we wanted to see it from all different angles, what was moving, what body part was moving and how did it move? And then you would videotape it so that when he went into his private studies, he was able to master it, and it was really, really cool because, check this out. This is how bad Michael Jackson was. I practiced with him just once, one time during the rehearsal for the Victory Tour. And it was a long, it was a modest session, depending on their schedule, okay? But check this out. In one session at the Victory Tour, that out of that one session, if you look at Michael Jackson's Billie Jean performance at the Victory Tour versus just before that at Motown, you could see it was 0 to 60 because in Billie Jean and the Victory Tour, He does the Billie Jean solo, but now there's a breakdown, and now he's floating forward, and then he goes into a circle. He never did that at Motown, and that was me. That was the beginning. That was the beginning of my implementation, because now before he did Billie Jean, he come on and threw his hat boom for the Victory Tour. The thing is, now the man had some other steps to play with. So that was the beginning of what he realized that I could contribute to him. And the rest was, of course, you know, my kick walk and my animation and the toy-looking thing. But, right around that time, a lot of Richie's All Night Long tour, that was probably the biggest thing that was happening, is the forming of Michael Jackson's solo freestyle. But while that was happening, the audition for the movie Breaking was up, and sure enough,
the Michael Jackson
story was a lot bigger, you know, as a precursor to the Breaking thing. So what happened was, well, we're doing all this wonderful stuff with Mr. Jackson, and in touring with Lionel Richie, towards the end of the tour, we get back, and Lionel Richie wrapped his tour up at the Universal Amphitheater. So while we were there, our agent, Shabani had an agent, Seven Bars and Benari, he came to us and said, look, Hollywood's getting ready to, there's two scripts out there for two films. And the movie Flashdance had did some really big box office numbers. So now there were these people rushing these scripts. They had the movie Breaking, and then they had another movie called Body Rock. Body Rock, Breaking, Body Rock and Breaking were coming out. And New York had a movie called Beat Street, but we didn't know about it. So the thing is, our agents said, you know what, if you take the movie Breaking, it's going to give you a chance to not only dance, but you'll be able to start an acting career, because now they're going to offer you lines in the film. So sure enough, we decided to read for the movie Breaking. And then, you know, they were pairing up different characters. Canon Films at the time, they were pairing up different people to play Turbo and Ozone and then the other people. So they were bringing in people to see who would match with those characters. Well, we already had chemistry because we had already been on a world tour with Lionel Richie and hanging out as friends. So we already had that bond that you could not fake as camaraderie, Shabani and I. So when we walked in, we killed it. It wasn't like somebody gave me the part, as some liars have said. We both had to work and audition and show Canon Films that chemistry. Because Turbo and Ozone have been said to be the Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin of hip hop. Because Shabadoo had that suave, debonair kind of big brother thing, and I was a laughable, you know, funny guy ready to just go and be the guardian on the dance floor. So the thing is, I was always like that, so the chemistry transposed and we got the gig. It was no handouts or no favoritism or somebody saying, hey, you know what? Get this guy a part. The thing is, we both earned those roles and those parts on our credibility of our skill level and then on our limit. It's not like we were actors, but we were pretty good at improv. So the thing is, that's how I got the film Breaking, and that's how the rest of my career started.
So you guys do this film. It becomes a cult favorite. And years later, there are scenes now, there's the internet, your scene with the broom. If you people, my audience out there, if you haven't seen the film Break In and this classic broom dance, tell us, first of all, what the experience was like doing your first film, major film. And I know you have been dabbling in documentary stuff like that. But what was that like? And how did that broom dance sequence come about?
Well, I thought that it was really fascinating that finally, after all these years, people were paying attention to a little black guy that was called Kunta and Toby for many years. Now everybody's jocking me, you know, and saying my name and allowing me to show up, and I'm not getting in trouble, and I can dance as long as I want. So I, you know, you couldn't tell me anything, because, like I said, for many years before that, I never forgot how bad black was to people, you know, and how stereotype a black man in a neighborhood was. So now I was like, wait a minute. I got a whole platform, and I could dance how I want to, and my hair could be as nappy as I want to, and you know what? I'm accepted. So you can't, and at the end of the day, you're going to say my name. I was like, wow, you couldn't tell me anything. So the thing is, but then there was another part of me that said, okay, now I need to man up and be responsible for what I'm like 16, almost 17 years old. And I had already been around a lot of people older than me, so I was a lot wiser than my years. So the responsibility, I was like, you know what, if you really look at my face and you really look at me in the movie Breaking, I was kind of very soft-spoken, but when it came to dancing, I was very focused. Meaning, if you look at my dance, I took my dancing very serious. I just let my dancing speak for itself. So when it came to the broom wasn't even part of the script. What happened was, during the course of filming, and let me back up. For the record, a lot of the stuff that's in the movie Breaking, that was all improv, because Cannon Films was an Israeli production that had no idea about hip-hop culture. They just thought, okay, we have an idea for a script, but we need to kind of organically kind of improv this. And most of Cannon Films were kind of B films that worked. Some of them didn't. But with this, because they knew that they had, you know, real talent with the real dancers, like some of their films, they got the real martial artists, you know, to do mediocre acting, but do real martial arts, that we carry our lines, they had us do a lot of improv. So the thing is, they knew I was a comedian, so they were like, you know what, just set up the scenario, set up the situation, and tell Boo Shrimp, okay, now you're going to do this, and go over here and do it, and then what are you going to say? And then they go, okay, now when we look at them, just improvise it. So a lot of my one-liners and a lot of stuff was just improvised. So that kind of showed a lot about them allowing me to develop my ability to improv even by dance, because they just set the scene up and then just let the camera roll, and, you know, through editing, it all came out. So with the broom, I was doing all this great stuff up until the last few weeks of filming, and we were in rehearsal, and I was just messing around with a prop in the rehearsal. I was balancing a broom on my finger upside down and doing my glide, my floating. And the director and producer were looking at me. They were watching me messing around. They're like, uh-oh. So now the prop people are like, hey, hold on. So they got a prop guy and got some fishing string and put it in, and they said, okay, look, put your hand through this and do what you're doing and see what you can do. So as I'm messing around with it, the choreographer of the film said, wow, now we got something that's kind of like Fred Astaire, who I didn't even really know about. He's like, wow. Now look, the choreographer of the film that's on record, he was one of the original members of West Side Story, Hyman Rogers. So the thing is, he already knew about big musicals and Bob Fosse and Fred Astaire and Gene Kelly. He knew about those big solos. So for him to see that kind of quality in my broom dance, he was like, okay, you know what? Now this is really going to take the movie to another level, because the script is, you know, everybody dumps on the Breaking script. It's not a lot, you know, it's not an Academy Award winning movie. The acting is mediocre. But they knew that. But Hyman Rogers said, okay, you know what, we're going to let the dancing carry this movie. And sure enough, By me messing around on the set, we worked it out and we staged the dance number. And my favorite thing about that I've heard, I've only heard it once in my lifetime. They said that the broom dance number was one of the first hip hop theatrical pieces in cinema. Now, it's interesting, that was authentic, because just before that, Flashdance had Jennifer Beals, you know, look like she did all this great stuff in Flashdance, but the truth is, they put crazy legs from Rocksteady in Jennifer Beals' costume and made her look like she did windmills and breakdancing at the end of the movie, and it was all this great stuff, but I didn't have a stunt person in Breaking One. I had him in step number two, but not number one. But the thing is, that's where the merit of what the broom dance stood for was, you know, allowing people like the Jabberwockies and all this really cool stuff we see on TV now and in television to have a form and show that street dancing with props and special effects can be an optical, you know, illusion and something really cool, you know, on film. You know, this is before CGI.
Right. This is Michael Boogaloo Shrimp Chambers dropping bombs.
That broom dance.
Wide world of hip hop.
Theatrical piece.
Right. We're going to go from there, Mike. Breaking One and Two became classics. And you continued your career in show business. We've got about five more minutes. Explain because you've appeared on stage as some of the most famous people in the world. Go through a list of his name, drop some of the people you've done shows with, and then tell us what Michael Boogaloo Shrimp Chambers is doing today.
I've been on stage with the world famous Patti LaBelle. Patti LaBelle was one of my favorites. I did a thing at the World Tour with her to Lady Marmalade. I danced on stage with Patti. I danced for Bette Midler. I've danced with let's see, of course, Lionel Richie with Michael. Let's see, geez. I danced side by side with Keanu Reeves in the movie Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey with Jaleel White playing the robot Steve Urkel. I danced side by side with Paula Abdul playing the cat in Opposite to Track. I danced for Chaka Khan and I Feel For You.
That was you in Opposites Attract?
Yeah, you can go on YouTube under Rare Opposites Attract and it actually shows the video of Opposites Attract before they put the cartoon character.
So they put the cartoon character over you, the cat.
See, then what happened was Paula Abdul wanted the cat character, something really cute, something different. And sure enough, I walked in the audition, and they seen the facial expressions and the way that I moved, and her and I were represented by the same agent, Julie McDonald. We were represented, so it was easier to do that video, and the rest was history. You know, we pulled it off, and let's see, who
that
else did I?
That was a hell of a video. I remember. That made Paula Abdul's career.
Yeah, it did, and you know what? It launched the whole album, MC Scat Cat. MC Scat Cat had the Scat Strut album on Virgin Records, and matter of fact, she had the character of Scat Cat coming out, you know, on tour. But that was a major step. Unfortunately, you know, I didn't really get it because it was an animated character. A lot of people had no idea that it was me, which would have been a benefit because it would have shown what I've done after the movie Breaking. I started still working in choreography and dancing. But yeah, the thing is. Those truths and a lot of those things are on YouTube and through archives, and so I'm very thankful with the people who bring out that information. But yeah, I got a chance to work with Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter from Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, Jaleel White on Family Matters, Dom DeLuise. I was on the Dom DeLuise show for a couple seasons. I got a chance to work with him. And you know what? The most recently, Steve Harvey. I was featured on the Steve Harvey show. I worked with Jimmy Kimmel. I was featured on the Jimmy Kimmel show. George Lopez. And like I said, there's some other names, but yeah, it's been an interesting ride. One of my favorite parodies was when Dave Chappelle did the broom dance. When Dave Chappelle did his broom dance and the R&B singer Ginuwine for his song "None of Your Friends' Business," when he did the broom dance, I was shocked.
Wow. Okay, so Michael Boogaloo Simp Chambers, the man who taught Michael Jackson the moonwalk. What are you doing now, and where can people find you on the internet if they want to book you, if they want to have you up for personal appearance for speaking engagements?
For all serious inquiries, for booking me for speaking events, because I'm all about inspiring people and sharing my story to help people maybe navigate their careers or maybe just kind of get that extra boost to keep going from wherever they started. You can, for bookings or for inspirational speaking, you can reach me at boogalooshrimp2001@yahoo.com, or even so, Disco Daddy, if some people want to write into your website or your show in lieu of this interview.
Mike, you know that.
The love will be reciprocated, but yeah, you know, I could be found on Facebook under Michael Boogaloo Shrimp Chambers, but you know, considering this interview or whatever, wherever it's run or whatever, if somebody wants to book me on something, just go ahead and contact Mike, and then we'll go from there. But yeah, you know, I do speaking events, hosting, and I also teach my methods. And like I said, I mean, I definitely appreciate this forum and being able to speak about my history. I did want to give some very, very important shout outs to a couple of people who don't know how much I respect. Well, this shout out goes to Bruno Mars. Thank you so much, Bruno Mars. Bruno Mars has tweeted that he watched my film, and he said nobody boogies like your boy Turbo. He also works with Armin Flores, who was the Jabberwocky's manager. So I want to give a shout out to Bruno Mars, Justin Bieber. Thank you, guys. Usher Raymond, Lady Gaga. I want to give a shout out to Chris Brown, Snoop Dogg, Ice Cube, and all the hip hop people that are continuing World of Dance, Dancing with the Stars. Everybody who's on the show, Blackish. Everybody who's doing dance, everybody who's doing hip hop, and everybody who's in that hip hop loop and showing love to not only the new school but the pioneers. And also too, I want to give a shout out to the Radiotron innovators and you, Disco Daddy, for pioneering and keeping hip hop truths real while the people are still alive and workable, and making sure that everybody gets their due respect. And your mission with the hip hop museum and uniting the different coasts and the different people together so that we can show the young people that we got unity, but be able to teach them and they can see an example of unity. So I appreciate that,
thank
man.
Thank you. And we want to thank you, Michael Chambers, for your contribution to hip hop, and not just hip hop, to the world of dance, period. Okay, you set an example for people to follow and young people to want to aspire to, and we want to thank you for doing our show, taking your valuable time out to do Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. You know, we got your support, you got our support, and we're going to continue our association and friendship from here on out. Michael Boogaloo Shemp Chambers on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop.
Well, thanks again for having me. You guys have a wonderful day, and I look forward to hearing more things about what you guys are going to be into in the days to come.
Thank you, Michael. We love you, bro.
And as we said again, take care.
All right, peace.
Bye-bye, Pete.
So wasn't it a great show? Come back next week, every Saturday at 1 p.m., Pacific Time, 3 p.m., Central Time, 4 p.m., Eastern Standard Time, Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop Show. Man, it's a great one. Epic. See you next week. Bye.